This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
You are listening to iFanboys Talksplode with Matt Rosenberg. Josh Flanagan from iFanboy, and I'm here with Matt Rosenberg. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. I'm glad this worked out. We've chatted a few times, and as always, it takes a little while to sort of get everybody together at the same time, but I'm excited. Let's do this. It's funny, because I know you, but I don't really know you. You know, it's like you're a guy. We've chatted. You know, we're familiar. We've exchanged a PM or a DM here and there.
This is true.
I was sort of thinking about what I was going to talk about, and I was like, there's a lot of blind spots here for me. So, I assume because you know Ron Richards, you're from the Long Island area. Is that true? Or is that...
No, you know, what's funny is that Ron must have this incredible gravity to him, because everyone, when I'm like, oh yeah, I've known Ron for years, everyone's like, oh, you're from Long Island. And I'm like, no. Maybe he never left Long Island, and everyone assumes that if I know him, I must have been there. No, I'm from the city. I'm from Manhattan.
Okay.
But I grew up going to shows on Long Island and all over the place. And, you know, he did his fanzine, and I was a fan of it. And my roommate wrote for Muddle and all sorts of stuff. So, yeah.
So you were a city kid.
Yes, very much so.
Like, you grew up like in Manhattan?
In Manhattan.
Wow.
Never left. Lived in Manhattan my whole life. Still do.
It's changed a lot. Anyway, the most obvious sentence ever. So
less people are being shot, it seems like. I'm wrong. Maybe I'm out of touch, but it seems like less people are being shot in Manhattan.
I mean, from what I've read, I grew up in Maine, so it was always my first thing was when I was watching SNL, and they had a sketch where the thing was like, it was a tourist board thing, and the joke was a pamphlet that said, "So you've been stabbed." In the late 80s, that was a thing.
Oh, sure, yeah.
So have you always been a comic book guy? Have you always wanted to work in comics?
You know, it's funny. I've always been a comic book guy. I grew up, like, I learned to read stealing my brother's comics. I grew up with a comic shop on my block. So, like, I don't have a lot of the, like, funny touchstones that a lot of people have of, like, oh, I got my books at 7-Eleven or whatever, because I was like, no, I had a comic book store. I had a proper comic book store since I was a toddler that was, you know, across the street from my house. But I never... Because comics was like on my front door, it was never a group activity. It was never the same kind of thing. Like I had friends and we played video games and we skateboarded and we did all that stuff. But comics was always very solitary for me. And because of that, I think, you know, this is my own self-diagnosis or whatever, but it just making comics was not something that I ever really thought about. When I was 10, I drew them. I couldn't draw like Todd McFarlane, so I gave up. And like, I never looked back at trying to make comics. And it's weird now because a lot of my contemporaries and peers were like, oh yeah, I've been wanting to make comics since I was a little kid. And I haven't. I've been a fan since I was a little kid, but I wasn't trying to make them my whole life.
It's interesting. I had sort of the same, I mean, we're about the same age. So probably like, I remember being 10, 11, liking them. I didn't have comic book friends. It was just me. I did buy mine at the drugstore, but then I found the comic shop, which was pretty much nearby. You know, and I would read them, and I didn't have any friends to talk about. There was no internet, you know. Yeah. And I would draw, and I thought, oh, it's fun to draw, but I was like, I don't think I'm good enough to be a comic book artist. And it didn't occur to me that there was anything else to do with it until I was much older, I think.
Yeah, yeah, same, which is hilarious because both of my parents are writers, so you would think that it would dawn on me at some point that someone is writing these things, but it just didn't in that way. And like, yeah, I mean, still for me, comics is a very solitary thing. It takes sort of all my mental fortitude to be like, oh, I need to get out and talk about books and promote books and be a part of a community. Because for me, it's still like, oh no, I go to the shop, you know, late at night and pick up my books and go home and read them. And I'm not inclined to talk to people about them. I just sort of naturally am a comic hermit, I think.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, one thing I was thinking when I started seeing you get more work at Marvel, I thought that was kind of interesting because I thought of you as a guy who wanted to make comics, but not necessarily, you know, be working for Marvel, be doing the sort of big two superhero stuff. I don't know, for whatever reason, I was mixing punk rock aesthetic with, you know, you know, Ashcan Press, you were doing your own thing all the time. And now I look at the work and I say, well, you know, that makes perfect sense because obviously, you know, you knew what you were doing, but when did you get involved with comics? When did it become the plan, or was it the plan to sort of, you know, work for Marvel, to do stuff like that?
You know, it is funny because there is that, like, I think people who are, you know, familiar with sort of like the music culture I'm from, like when I started, people were definitely confused when I was like, oh yeah, I want to work for Marvel. I want to make like superhero comics. People were definitely like, really? Like that's, oh, that's weird. I think people thought that I'd much more be going down an eight ball or Hernandez brothers career trajectory. But yeah, I mean, for me, I was working in music and, you know, I basically like right out of school, you know, started hopping in bands and going on tour and traveling the world and putting out records and all that stuff. And, you know,
wait, so what does that mean when you say you were working in music? Like what was that what you were, you know?
Yeah, that's what I did for a living. I mean, when I was 16, I went to see a band. They needed a place to crash. I was living on my own. I said, you can crash in my house, in my apartment. That night they were like, yeah, you know, we don't have anyone to go on tour with us. We're going on tour for a month. And I was like, you know, they were like, we need someone to sell shirts and, you know, count the money and get us paid and all the sort of tour manager stuff. And I was like, I can do that. And they were like, sure, come on. And I didn't know them. And I hopped in their van and I went out for a month and I was still in high school. And, you know, I almost didn't graduate from high school because I went on tour for a month and was like mailing people postcards being like, I'm in Salt Lake City. And people were like, I'm in math class. And it wasn't a good fit. But
well,
from then on, I just always, you know, I've had every job in the music business you can have that doesn't involve having musical talent. Mm-hmm. So I tour managed bands. I ran a record label. I worked in a merch company. I did guitar teching. I've done merch. I've done, you know, worked at labels. I managed a record store for a year and a half. You know, pretty much the whole, you know, marketing and press and booking agent. I've dipped my toe in all of it. Mm-hmm. To differing degrees of success. The big thing was I put out records. I ran a record label for 9 years, with my girlfriend and we ran it out of our living room and, you know, people were always like, oh wow. You know, was it wildly successful? And I was like, no, but it paid the bills. So that, I mean, in indie music, that is wildly successful.
Yes, so. It is.
You know, sometimes the bills were paid and all that was left over was like, well, it's ramen for a month, but, they were paid almost all the time. So that's something.
So when you went on tour when you were 16, how old was the band?
They were in their 20s.
Yeah. And they said, let's take this 16-year-old kid with us. That'll work.
I think they were really, I realized very quickly, they were nice dudes, and I knew people who knew them, but they were, I realized very quickly that they were like just stoners, and they were like, they didn't want to figure out how to read a map. They didn't want to like know how long it took to drive to the next show. They didn't want to figure out how to find a place to stay. And they certainly didn't want to like chase promoters for money or try and sell merch. Mm-hmm. They wanted to play songs, get stoned, and get in a van. And so like basically anyone who had walked up to them at that point and was like, I'll do all the other stuff. They were like, yeah, you're hired. So, you know,
and how did you feel about that at the time? Were you like, oh, I can totally do this? Or were you making it up? I mean, I'm sure you were making it up as you went, but
well, I was definitely making it up as I went along. You know, it's fun until it's really fun until it's not. The first time a promoter is just like, no, I'm not paying you. And then you're like, I'm a 16-year-old kid. Like, I don't actually know what happens now when this scary dude. Or like, you know, I think the third day of tour, one of the other bands on tour got into a brawl with people in the crowd. And when we left, when we unloaded the show, there were like 20 dudes outside waiting for all the bands. And I was like, oh, I'm going to die in Cleveland. Like, this is a weird turn of events.
Was it hardcore?
No, they were actually a poppy punk band. It wasn't hardcore. You would think, you know, Cleveland has a great hardcore scene that's super violent. You think that's where we were going with this. But no, it was a pop punk band. So, yeah.
Like mid late 90s, mid-ish?
Yeah, mid-late okay. 90s.
Interesting.
The band who it was late 90s. The band who got in the fight were like street punk kind of dudes, mm-hmm. but the guys waiting outside didn't really discern whether or not we were wearing leather jackets. They were just
hold
like,
on. Let's slice this genre down to its parts before we fight.
Yeah, there was not a lot of like, hey, what are your influences here before I hit you with the brass knuckles I have on? No, I didn't get beat up. Everyone was fine. There were some people who were beat up, but I was not one of them because I was probably hiding. But regardless, it worked out.
It's
but
a survival technique.
It was fine. It was, you know, a lot of the stuff, especially in like punk rock, and I feel like the same thing is true in comics. There's such a strong... if you know where to look, there's a really good sort of community support network.
Yeah.
So the stuff I wouldn't know how to do, it never felt weird to not know how to do it because you could always be like, you know, you'd be on tour and there were four bands on the tour and I'd go to the other tour manager and be like, hey, I don't know how to like, you know, this club is taking a cut of the merchandise. Like, how do I do that? And they're like, oh, you just smuggle shirts in so you don't have to pay them and stuff like that. Where like everything is being, you know, it was never weird to sort of just ask for help. And so it was never as intimidating as it naturally should have been to just be like, I've never had a job before and I'm taking me and three strangers' lives into my hands.
It's interesting because, you know, I'd said earlier, you know, it seemed unexpected to do the Marvel stuff, but really comics and you know, DIY rock or doing whatever, like even the people at the highest level are making a comic is DIY, you know, like you're making
sure.
Stuff up. There's not a lot of people involved. You are, you know, it's sort of a very specific art. It's all sorts of things. I'm sure you know all the analogies. So it's not such a reach. If sort of, even when you just talk about the sort of experiences you have, I go, yeah, that works for comics. I can see the connection, sort of in those communities, I guess. So when did comics become a thing for you then?
Like making them?
Like making comics. Not just,
you know, I hit a point. The music industry had a really spectacular collapse. And when money starts to dry up, friendships become a different kind of thing and business relationships become a different thing. And I'd survived a long time being like a handshake kind of guy and like my word is my word and you're working with friends and it just sort of became a thing where like, you know, there were lawyers getting involved in stuff and we had over the course of the 9 years that we ran our label, I think six of our distributors went bankrupt and, you know, it was like $30,000 or $40,000 that just vanishes. Mm-hmm. And when you're living on peanut butter sandwiches, like being like, oh, like those people who owe us $14,000 just had their phones repossessed. Like where that $14,000 is gone. Like, it becomes just an endless sort of beating that really, And I hit a point, I called a buddy of mine who ran a record label, and I was like, man, I'm feeling really burned out. And he was like, well, what do you mean? And I was like, I just don't want to go to shows. I don't want to like put on records when I get home. I'm just like sort of exhausted. And he was really stunned. And he was like, wait, you still go to shows for fun? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, you still listen to music recreationally? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, he's like, you're not burned out. This is just like working in the music business. This is what it is. Like, you just hit a point where like you hate it. And I was terrified of that. He was like, oh no, I don't. He's like, I don't listen to records unless it's a band I'm going to sign. Wow. And I was like, oh, okay. I don't want that. And that conversation for me was like a major moment of like, I need to get out. Like, I need to get out of this now. And I, in my not very smart brain, I just was like, you know, I love music and I don't want to keep doing this until I don't love music. Mm-hmm. So I need to find something else to do with my life. And what else do I love as much as music? And I was like, comic books. So I decided to go into a equally as perilous career that also has a lot of people who have grown to hate it as they do it for a living. So yeah, I made the odd transition into comics then.
So were you reading comics all along? Were you in touch with what was sort of happening?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I sort of dipped in it. I never like stopped reading comics like a lot of people, but like, you know, I grew up reading Marvel stuff and then sort of discovered the, you know, the eight balls and hates of the world and sort of fell in love with all that stuff and sort of drifted away from superhero stuff. And, you know, I think in the, you know, there's a period where I think when like, you know, guys like Bendis were coming in with their crime stuff that I was getting really back into comics. Like, I was more casually, like, I'd see a comic shop and stop in, but it wasn't a weekly destination for me kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It was like, you know, in a bad year, it was like every other month I'd go to the comic shop. And then I just sort of like, there a few writers really sort of really started speaking to me and getting me really excited about what they were doing. And I just was like, oh, I'm spending more and more money on comics. And that was around the time that I was getting really burned out on music. And interestingly, a big turning point for me was someone randomly, I was talking to someone randomly and I said something about Steve Niles and mm-hmm. how I liked Niles' work and I was a fan, and they were like, oh, do you like him because of the punk rock stuff? And I was like, I don't know what the punk rock stuff is. And they were like, well, he was in Grey Matter, the 80s, 90s Discord band, and from DC. And I was a huge Grey Matter fan. I mean, they were before my time, but I loved their records. And I was like, the Steve Niles who wrote 30 Days a Night is the same Steve Niles who was in Grey Matter? And people were like, and whoever was talking to was like, yeah, yeah, it's the same dude. Like, he writes comics. And that to me was like amazing because I didn't know anyone who made comics at all. Mm-hmm. And so like, I didn't know Steve, but like it was someone from the same sort of community years before. But I was like, oh, that's the first person I could point to where I was like, oh, people make, like real people make these. Like, these are actual humans making these comics. And that was a big thing that, like, stuck in my mind. And when I was like, I got to get on music, like, Steve was a big guy that I sort of looked to. Mm-hmm.
So what's the step to the next thing is where you say, I want to try to make comics. I want to do that. And also, like, were you, had you been a storyteller before that? Had you?
No. No, not at all.
This is a lot like the first time when I talked to Mark Russell and I was like, had you ever made comics? He's like, no.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. my parents are writers and I saw what that life was like and growing up, and you know, my dad is a very successful writer and
what kind of writers?
I mean, what kind?
Yeah, like fiction writers or journalists.
My dad was a he wrote 9 novels and a book of essays and he was the head writer on 6 seasons of network TV shows nominated for an Emmy. And then, he's the most prolific TV movie writer in history, actually.
I did not know that. So like a real full-time working writer.
Oh yeah.
Which is funny, 'cause I didn't even know that existed until I was almost out of college. I had no idea that that would be a thing that somebody could do. And I was like, I wish I'd known about this earlier. Helpful.
Yeah. It is weird because it's like, I have a very weird relationship to like, especially when I started writing comics, mm-hmm. because you know, there's that thing where people, you know, I was out there trying to network and trying to meet people. And I'd say like, oh, I'm trying to be a writer. And people would be like, hey, you're not trying to be a writer. Like, mm-hmm. you are a writer. And to me, I was always like, I get what you're saying. And I understand the sentiment is like very positive and encouraging. But like, to me, writing is like, that's every meal I ate as a child. That's like the roof over my head. That's all my clothes. And like my education is writing. Like, and I would always like sort of be like, yeah, no, I get it. And they'd be like, no, take that to heart. And I was like, I don't, because to me, and I understand why it's important for other people to hear that. And I agree with the sentiment, but to me it was like, no, like my dad's a writer and he's paying the bills or he's not paying the bills based on the work. And like, you know, no one would be like, hey, I'm trying to be a doctor. And you'd be like, hey, mm-hmm. if you're trying to be a doctor, you are a doctor. And it's like, well, yeah, I mean, it's a little different because writing is a creative field and it's a passion. And like, it's not about someone cashing a check. And I get all that. But to me, I always had the mental barrier of like, if I'm not paying my rent doing this, can I really call myself this?
Did you think that way about musicians?
No, not at all. my favorite bands in the world, like I would know what their day jobs were, and sure. they were, you know, crappy day jobs so that I could quit them and go on tour. But like, I'd go see my favorite band serving, you know, delivering pizza. And I'd be like, yeah, it's cool. They're an amazing band. It doesn't matter. So I don't know why that hang up was personal. I think it's just ingrained from, sure. you know, my parents. But
and I'm sure if he's working on, you know, network TV shows, he knows a lot of people who want to call themselves writers but aren't because they can't get that job, and that's a yeah, different thing.
You know, I never talked to my dad about it. I don't think he would agree with me if I said, like, I think he's one of the people who'd be like, no, if you put pen to paper, like, you're a writer, you don't need, you know, NBC to pay you.
You're not a professional writer, though.
Yeah, but and my mom only ever wrote, she wrote other things, but she only wrote one thing that ever got made. She wrote a slasher movie.
Oh, wow.
That was made. She was an editor for a long time. She was a book editor, though. But yeah, so no, I wasn't, to backtrack, I wasn't creative because I saw what it worked like, what their work was like and what life was like and what it was like when, you know, there was no writing to be had. And I was like, I don't ever want to do that. I want more stability and structure and you know, less all-nighters. And
so you thought indie rock was the way to go?
Yeah, that was a smart choice. Well, I didn't know anyone to do it. I didn't have, you know, if my parents were in Sonic Youth, I probably would have been like, no, I'm going to be a writer. I want more stability. But, you know, here we are. But the, you know, so I vehemently did everything I could to not be a writer. I mm-hmm. sort of would have opportunities to write and I'd be like, no, I don't want to do that. And then when I was leaving music, I was like, well, I guess I'm going to write comics. And I just was like, my buddy Patrick Kinlan, who's a great writer, comics writer now, but he's the front man in a bunch of bands that I was friends with. And he was the only friend I had who liked comics. And he was the only person I knew who talked about comics. And I knew he was a great writer. And I was like, hey, we should figure out how to write comics. And he was like, yeah, let's do it. Because he's that kind of guy. We'll just be like, yeah, let's go. You know, I could have been like, hey, we should figure out how to be bank robbers. And he'd probably be like, yeah, let's do that. That sounds awesome. Like, let's figure it out. Maybe we do it, maybe we don't. But like, what a cool thing to learn. And so we just dove in headfirst on like, can we do this? Can we write comics? Like, I didn't know what a comic script looked like. I didn't know how you hire an artist. I didn't know. You know, I remember reaching out to artists and like, you know, artists, you can get there's a thing in comics when, you know, people seem like they're not really, people reach out to you for work and you don't actually want to work with them. Mm-hmm. You give them a thing called a fuck you rate, which is like, you know, an absurd rate to hire you. Mm-hmm. And if they'll pay it, you'll take the work because they're paying you an absurd amount of money, but mostly it's to get them to go away. And the first artist I ever reached out to gave me that rate. And I remember having like a true panic attack because I was like, oh, these people make so much money. Like I can't self-publish. I can't hire working artists. Like it'll cost me $40,000 or $60,000 to make a single issue of a comic book. And then I like looked around more and I was like, wait, this guy's working and it's, you know, he's making 1/10 of that. That's fine. So,
was it I don't need you to tell me, but like, was it a name? Was it a person like did you reach out to somebody who was way above
No. I reached out to someone who was working and is great, and I'm still a fan of, but is not.
Do you know him now?
Do I know him?
Like, do you know him professionally? Or?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, would he know that he did that?
No, I don't think so.
At some point early on, I reached out to a bunch of people who are artists who are, many are pros now, and it was some amateur shit on my part because I didn't even have money. I was like, can we just work together? Which is the lamest thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I definitely did that too. Yeah. And, I wasn't above shooting my shot and just being like, hey, you know, if I see Jim Lee, I'm going to ask him. Like, stuff like that. But, you know, like, I still, I learned quickly enough that I was like, I need to be on message boards and finding, you know, people who don't know what they're doing as much as I don't know what I'm doing. And I need to be, you know, I quit my jobs sold a lot of my record collection and I had a lot of video games. I sold those to pay artists because I was just like, yeah, I got to pay these guys. And I don't really have a job, so I'm working pretty meager for a while. But it worked out, I guess. I'm probably in the black now, I hope.
So, like, how do you get, like, what's the first thing you do? How do you get started with that? Like, do you find somebody? Did you have a story in mind? How'd you learn how to write comics? Like, where do you go from nothing?
I knew that craft-wise, I wasn't up to snuff in just every way. And so my buddy Patrick and me, I was like, hey, we should do a thing where every Monday we have to pitch each other two stories in a certain genre or with a certain set of limitations, but like do a full pitch and then, you know, like give each other critiques on them and sort of figure it out. And from, we spent 6 months doing that, where every Monday we'd be like, okay, next week, Westerns. Like, okay, next week, horror. Like, okay, next week, like, single room mystery. Or, you know, like locked room mystery. Like, whatever it was. And we'd just, like, try and come up with as many stories as we could to sort of just figure out how to pitch and how to do that. And then after, like, 4 or 5 months of that and, like, really crash-coursing stuff, I was reading script books and I was poring over interviews with creators I liked and I was, like, lurking message boards and like looking at art forums and, you know, all that stuff. And then we started writing up scripts and basically cold emailing people. And the first person that emailed was the pro who didn't want to work with me. But after that, you know, it was a lot of like people who didn't have published work who were just like on forums just being like, hey, you know, these are my samples. Like, you know, if anyone has paying work, and I'd email them and be like, yeah, I got, you know, a 5-page thing, like a 5-page pitch. Can I give you $75 a page to do it? And that kind of thing, where it's like crappy rates and, you know, a lot of people like, you know, you meet people who it's like, oh, you don't, that actually isn't your work that you put up there and you're going to turn in stuff that doesn't look like that. And, you know, we were outsourcing stuff to like a Chinese art studio where like their translation stuff wasn't up to snuff. And like, we were getting back pages that were insane. You know, just all these sort of classic pitfalls of not really knowing what you're doing. And I mean, it is, not to go back to it, but like making comics is really, it is a lot like being in a band where it's like about synchronizing and who fits and figuring each other out. And so these cold emails where you're just like, hey, I have a story. Would you like to draw it, with no specificity? And then the person is like, yes, I want money. I'll draw it. And you end up with something like, you know, you end up with those weird things where like, you know, you answer a flyer being like, do you like this band? Come play music with me. And it's like, that's not actually enough connectivity to.
And not everyone becomes the Pixies, as I understand it.
Yeah, yeah. I like the Pixies. You like the Pixies. Let's play songs.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, well,
that was their flyer. Like, that's like, I forget what the band was, but like they basically listed like three disparate bands that had nothing to do with each other. And Kim Deal saw it, like quit her accounting gig and did that. Like, it was,
yeah,
but that's not, yeah, that's an outlier.
It works out sometimes. I'm sure it just didn't work out great for me. Although, you know, a couple of the people that I worked with, like when I started, they pop up from time to time and get work, and it's awesome to see because, you know, I was doing, me and Pat together, we did a ton of pitches, just like 5-page things to send to editors that never went anywhere. And a lot of them were terrible because of us, because we didn't know what we were doing and didn't know how to write scripts and didn't know how to tell stories well. And it was like a very expensive way to learn.
Well, it's interesting though, because I mean, the next question that I had for you is sort of like, how do you go from I want to do this to really understanding the craft? Because there is that early part where, I mean, and I went through this to a certain extent. I didn't take it obviously as far, and but like where you're really thinking about like, well, what makes an artist good? What, why would this work? What, where do these things fail? Why are they in? And that's a fairly long learning process. And I'm guessing it's shorter if you're paying out of pocket to get people to do it.
Yeah. I mean, I spent a lot of, you know, once you're paying out of pocket, it becomes very quick when reading comics recreational becomes studying comics. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, my bookshelf and my long boxes were went from my favorite hobby to my classroom really quick. But one of the things I did that was really, really helpful to me, actually, I'd had towards the end of running the label, like, money was tight, and I took a job at a screen printing shop. I was managing a merch company that used to do merch for my bands, and they were like, yeah, you can come on. And so I was running the label, and I was also running this merchandising company, and I was getting paid really well. And I was like, no, I need to cut all of this out. Like, I need to just be comics. And I quit, and I took a job and a tremendous pay cut to work in a comic book store, just because I was like, I want to be around comics. I want to, like, be living and breathing comics, and I don't have the experience to get a job at a publisher, so I'm going to get a job at a comic book store. And also, I wanted the ability to, like, go to conventions when I was self-publishing stuff, but also, like, at 5 o'clock, punch out and not have anything hanging over me, have no attachment. And that was, you know, a retail job was great for that. I know that there are a lot of people who work in comic stores are super passionate and live and breathe their comic store. But I didn't know that at the time. I took it to be like, yeah, I've worked retail before. And I just, you know, when I walk out of the door, I never think about the job until I have to walk back in the door the next time. Mm-hmm. So that was a huge learning thing for me, was working in a comic shop in New York City.
It's you're friends with Donnie, right? Like, he told me that you guys are really, and he had like the same, like he was in that comic store to learn, do all those things. That's interesting.
Donnie worked in the store longer, ascended higher than I ever did in my comic store job, but I think crashed out and burned more gloriously than me. So yeah, I think there's a good parallel between our lives right there.
So you're making you know, shorts and comics and stuff like that. And it sounds like you're at least smart enough to do 5 pages and not a huge graphic novel that no one ever read. But what do you do with that stuff? Like, where does Ashcan Press come into this?
Okay. So, we were making these 5-page pitches, and I was meticulously figuring out, you know, how to pitch and who to pitch to and who editors were, and, you know, like, obsessively learning all the editors at every company and, you know, going to cons and being able, crafting the ability to go up to an editor and not just talk to them about comics, but like actually engage in small talk, which is remarkably harder when you're straight edge and, not, you know, like the bar con is a very real thing that I love, but like, you know, people who are good at bar con, there are bad comic creators who are good at bar con, and you see them at bar con and you're like, oh, that's your career. It's like, you're the fun person to drink with, and I am the grumpy dude with a chocolate milk in the corner who does not want to be in a hotel bar. So that's always, that was a big setback that I learned pretty quick. But yeah, I mean, it's funny because when you think about it, like, there's so many comics and so many publishers and so many amazing, you know, comics coming out. But at the same time, like, when you're trying to do this for a living, it becomes very clear very quickly that, like, at any given time, there are 8 to 12 publishers who are actually paying for work. There are obviously different editors and different, you know, execs at companies who greenlit stuff and can approve work or bring you in. But essentially, you're trying to sell comics to 12 people when you're doing pitches. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, we were doing these 5-page pitches and finding those 12 people at, you know, Image and Dark Horse and Oni and Boom and, you know, Top Shelf and Vertigo and all these companies, and just trying to get them in their hands and you know, all the way, you know, companies like AIT, Planet Lar, like Slave Labor, like companies that are just putting out books that we like, where we're just like, hey, let's just get books out. And it's 12 people. And yes, you said you were smart to do the 5-page thing and not the whole thing. And in some ways that's very true. Because we could put more eggs in our basket, but at the same time, it is, you know, a lot of eggs to be in one basket. And you hit a point. Editors are great. Editors are amazing. And the one thing that is universally true across comics is that every editor is overworked. And they aren't, they're looking for reasons to reject pitches. They're looking for reasons not to care. And just because they don't have the time or the bandwidth to like be invested in stuff that isn't a sure shot and they don't think is a slam dunk. And so what happens is you end up sending out this comic that this pitch that you spent 6 months working on and, you know, 6 months of your money to pay for, and you send it to these 12 people and 10 of them don't respond even because they don't have the time and because they know that responding to comics creators, it looks like a crack in the door where you can be like, but wait, did you know that this, and they don't want to be in those conversations. They don't have the time.
And there are dozens and dozens of you, if not hundreds, for every one of them.
Oh, hundreds and hundreds. Yeah. And if you answered every pitch that came in with a rejection notice and then got the email back being like, thanks for your time, but also, you know, I think you misunderstood something about the main character. Like, you know, that's a whole job. Like, right. That in itself would be just a very busy, time-consuming job, regardless of the actual editing of the actual comics they're making. And so you end up, as a creator, getting a deafening silence for your pitches over and over and over again. And that, I did that until I was just about broken. Mm-hmm. And then I hit a point where I was like, well, you know, I don't even have a full story. Like, I don't have a full issue. I can't set up at a convention because 7 different pitches with 7 different artists, I can't sell that to people. I can't be like, do you want to read? And, you know, it's like opening a film studio that only puts out trailers. It's not going to work. And so we made the decision, me and Pat, to actually pay to make books. And we were like, rather than making 4 pitches in 6 months, like, we're going to make one book and my idea, which in hindsight was a very bad idea, was I was like, oh, we're going to call it Ashcan Press. We're going to make it look like a publisher. We're going to make ourselves look super professional. And we're just going to walk into the room like we're published comic creators and be like, yeah, Ashcan Press publishes us. That's them. Like, here's the website. Here's the Twitter. Here's the domain. Here's the banner. Here's the logo on the book. Here's the P.O. box. And so I did that. I made the whole thing look like a publisher for a bit. And then when we started pitching it to people, people were like, wait, isn't Ashcan Press putting this out? And I'd be like, no, that's just us. Never mind. And we totally blew it. Like, it was totally no publisher wants to pick up your book because they think you're already being published by someone. So it was a good idea for like 2 minutes, but then it was a terrible idea. But it stuck. So Ashcan Press was the branding.
I see. Well, that's interesting. So when does it change? Like, what happens differently when you're getting real frustrated? You've tried this Ashcan Press approach that didn't work. You know, how do we get from here to there?
Yeah. So, I hit a point, I was pitching stuff and it wasn't, I got my first anthology story, going, and I was really excited about that. And then I got a call from a guy who was someone who knew me from my time in music and then knew I was trying to do comics, put me in touch with this guy, and he called me, and he just called me up and out of the blue, and he was like, hey, man, I work for a recording artist. We want to do a comic book. Can I take you out to lunch and pick your brain? And I was so broke and so, desperate for anything that I was like, the guy, you know, a free lunch is all I needed to hear. He could have been like, hey, man, I want to hit you with a hammer. Can I take you to lunch first? I'd be like, yeah, let's go to lunch and we'll see where it goes. So I went to lunch and a guy picked my brain for 2 hours. And then at the very end of the meeting, I was like, hey, man, you got to tell me who this is for. You know, like, I'll sign an NDA. I'm just desperately curious. And he was like, oh, yeah, it's I'm on RZA's management team. And RZA and Ghostface Killah from the Wu-Tang Clan are trying to do a comic. And I was like, oh, okay. Everything I told you, you can throw out because, like, the rules are totally different when you're super famous and super loved rappers. And so I stayed in touch with them and kept talking to RZA's management team. And then they were like, yeah, RZA wants to meet you. And I went out to the studio and hung out with RZA. And talked to him about comics for a long time. And then the next day they were like, yeah, do you want to write the comic actually? And I was like, yeah, let's go. And then very quickly they were like, do you want to put the whole thing together with the art team and everything? And I was like, yep, let's do it. And so I wrote the comic and I put it together, and that was my first thing. And I brought it to a bunch of publishers, and a lot of publishers were interested. We had great artists lined up, and a lot of hype, and some people were helping me out. Ron Richards was a big help, actually.
I remember talking to you about this back at the time, and I thought I was impressed. I remember going, oh, cool.
Yeah, yeah. It was definitely, the Wu-Tang opens doors for sure. And people go, oh, this is weird. And finally we ended up, Black Mask was just starting, and I knew them, and I brought it to them, and they were like, yeah, we can do it. Let's do it. And so we ended up doing, I did the book, at Black Mask. It's called 12 Reasons to Die. It's my first comic. And like right out of the gate, we were going, and it was much more work and much crazier than I thought it was going to be. And they were a brand new publisher, and it was their first book. And, it was really chaotic, but it was awesome. And I was like, okay, I'm not burned out on this. I love this. Like, I love every second of this. And it's,
right.
I think it was legitimately 6 months of like 4 hours sleep every night, because I was doing marketing and PR and art management and writing and like coordinating with a record label and coordinating with, Rizzo call you at 3 a.m. and be like, hey, come to the studio. And I'll be like, I live in Harlem. And he'll be like, studio's in Bushwick. Let's go. And I'd be like, all right, hour and a half subway ride, 4:30 a.m, get there. So it was chaos, but it was fun. And from there it just went, and, I finished that, and I pitched Black Mask, a creator owned thing called We Can Never Go Home. And they went for it, and it did well. And, we just sort of went from there. And then I did Four Kids Walking to a Bank there, and Marvel started asking me to do stuff. And yeah.
Did you feel like you were prepared when Marvel came around?
Prepared is weird. Yes and no. Mm-hmm. Like, I knew the stuff. I knew the stuff. I'm such a fan, and have been such a fan, and for so long, that I was like, well, I can talk to them like I know what I'm talking about. Whether or not I can make the book like I know what I'm doing is a different story. But when I got the email, it was one of those things where like I read the email 4 times. It was Jake Thomas, who's my editor on The Punisher and is one of the best editors in comics, emailed me, and he was just like, hey man, you're doing cool stuff. Would you want to come do a short story at Marvel? And it was like a 2-sentence email, and I read it 4 times and was like, I don't understand what this says. And I literally picked up my laptop, and my girlfriend was in the kitchen, and I brought my laptop into the kitchen, and I was like, hey, read this email and tell me what he's saying. And she screamed and hugged me, and she's like, oh my God, congratulations. And I was like, no, I literally am having trouble. Like, you need to explain what it says. And she's like, he wants you to do a short story. And I was like, right? That's what it says, right? So emotionally, I certainly wasn't prepared. Luckily, my buddy Frank Barberi, who I sort of came up with because I knew him through music. He was in bands in New Brunswick that I knew. And he was a good, when I was self-publishing, he was self-publishing, and we were doing the convention circuit together, like hopping in his car and driving to Chicago and sleeping on someone's floor and going to C2E2 and, setting up a table with our self-published books. Like, me and Frank were super tight. I mean, we still are. He's one of my closest friends. But he had started work at Marvel right before me. And so I immediately just called him and was like, oh my God, Marvel asked me to do a thing. What do I do? And he was like, okay, well, you want to do this. And he they were saying, there were things in notes that I was like, I don't know what this means. Like, I don't understand. And they were like, I would call him because I was too embarrassed to call the editor and be like, I don't know what this means, man. Which is funny because now I've been there for years, and every day I'm like, hey, I don't know what this note means. Like, what are you guys talking about?
You got to get that confidence to be able to say, I don't understand this. That's a good moment to reach. I think that's always.
Yeah. I think so. Being confident enough to look stupid is an important step for me. And I'm there, thankfully. So
now, I was thinking about this question, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but you tell me. When I think of your stuff, I don't really have a thing that I would. I don't have a way to pigeonhole you. I don't think Matt does this kind of thing, or he does these kinds of characters. you know, and you've done like a lot of different sort of stuff around Marvel and like, what would you say? Like, what is your favorite kind of thing to do? Is it you feel comfortable in any of the, you know, sort of different spaces, you know, in the Marvel universe kind of thing? Or, you know, like, what, I mean, do you have a style that you would say that way? I don't know.
I like that question. It probably is offensive, but I liked it anyway.
I've had that conversation with artists, and so it's easier with artists that, you know, wow, you have a bunch of different styles. You have, you know, your own, and yeah. I've asked that, and, you know, and it anyway, but I sort of was thinking that about your books, because I see your name on all sorts of different things. And there's not necessarily a through line, and that's not a bad thing. I just haven't been able to put it together.
No, I mean, there's definitely stuff, and I'm definitely like, I have enough distance now from some of my stuff to be like, okay, this is a better representation of me, and this is a better use of my voice, and this is a better kind of thing. But definitely when I started at Marvel, like, I think my indie comics feel different. Like, We Can Never Go Home and Four Kids have a sort of punk rock aesthetic. Yeah. They're sort of snarky, they're tongue in cheek, but they're like, you know, they transition from painfully earnest to like, you know, sort of comedic to heartbreaking and back and forth. And I think that's sort of a natural wheelhouse for me. Like,
I can see that in that stuff for sure.
And that stuff appears in some of my Marvel stuff. And I think some of the stuff that people really dig, like Hawkeye Freefall and Tales of Suspense and New Mutants and Astonishing X-Men and Kingpin, like, they do that where it transitions, and it's sort of a bunch of different, you know, it sort of blindsides you with, like, you don't know what you're walking into. And I sort of like to lean into that. But no, I mean, when I started the company, I remember early on, I was talking to Nick Spencer, and Nick Spencer, who I didn't know super well at the time, he was like, you know, what do you want to do here? And I was like, oh, no, I'll do anything, man. And he was like, that's not an answer. And I was like, no, that is an answer. There's literally no character I wouldn't like to write. Like, I'm a fan of the universe. I'm a fan of getting to play with this stuff. And even characters I don't love, like, I'd love to fall in love with them. I'd love to fall in love with them through writing them. Like, I want to do that. And he was like, sort of skeptical, and was kind of like, that's not how it works. But then I look back at my time at Marvel, and I'm like, oh yeah, I started and I was writing Rocket Raccoon and Kingpin at the same time. And I was writing, like, the foul-mouthed raccoon going through the trash, eating people's trash in Brooklyn. And also, like, this very honest, earnest Kingpin book about, like, a very troubled man trying to go straight and sort his life out. And I was like, oh, yeah, this sort of makes sense. This is exactly my time at Marvel. It's like, I'm writing two books that are at the complete opposite end of the spectrum, 100%. And it... You know, and I, you know, like, I just finished 2.5 years on Punisher and went straight into Hawkeye. And, like, there's a connective line that makes sense to me, but other people don't see it at all. And they're just like, Hawkeye is funny and lighthearted and, you know, so honest and so aspirational. And the Punisher is grim and brutal and disgusting and monstrous. And I'm like, yeah, but in my head, there's a connective tissue. But yeah, I mean, I like sort of.
Wait, what is that connective tissue? Because it's interesting, because, you know, historically, like, as a reader, Hawkeye's always been one of my favorite characters, and Punisher's a character I've never been able to be that interested in. I've read good Punisher stories, for sure, but I'm curious what your thought on that is.
You know, I mean, the obvious connective tissue is that they're non-powered people in the Marvel Universe. They're just dudes who have this burden and this sense of who they are and... Of just what the universe needs from them, and despite all odds, they're willing to go, you know, face death and do it. And how they do that is very different. And you know, obviously their origins are very different. But I think in some ways, like, they're both people who are colored by the fact that they are unexceptional in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And they surround themselves by exceptional people, and they go to war with exceptional people to prove that they are exceptional. And I think that there's a sort of, you know, in Punisher, it sort of manifests as this sort of suicidal thing. And in Hawkeye, it sort of is this, the opposite. It's a guy who's sort of acts suicidal, but won't look that in the eye. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something really, you know, I write them differently, but I think if you read enough of my Hawkeye and enough of my Punisher, you'll see that like, these are guys who get in over, they charge in over their heads without, I mean, neither of them is the Batman of the Marvel Universe. They're not people who have a plan for everything and have an angle. They're guys who are like, there's something wrong and I'm going to fix it and I'm going to come out swinging. And I think when you read my Punisher and my Hawkeye, the easiest connective thread is like, both of them are always very close to dying and one of them wants it really badly and one of them is terrified of it. Mm-hmm. And how they react to that colors everything in the book.
I can totally see that, which is going to lead me to my next question, which will be how far into working, you know, in comics or even at Marvel, were you able to talk like that, where you can sort of psychoanalyze these characters in such a way where you can say, this is what he wants, this is his thing? Cause it's one thing to sort of understand that, to be able to say it and pitch it. I mean, is that part of what, you know, you sort of learned as you trained yourself to be a professional comic book creator?
You know, it's weird because I learned to do it at Marvel first. Mm-hmm. Because I spent a lot of time being like talking to editors, being like, well, I think this guy might, and that's not what they want. They want to hear, this is what this person would do. They want you to have a take and a strong, smart take and be confident. And it shows in the work. And so I learned that I felt confident about my ideas, but I felt really weird about taking characters who are 100% not mine, who are, you know, going back to every comic creator I've ever loved has touched them and being like, this is what this person would do is a bold, you know, it takes real chutzpah to like be able to let those words come out of your mouth authoritatively. But I learned to do it at Marvel. And I think the place I learned to do it was Phoenix Resurrection. When I had to pitch Phoenix Resurrection, because it was the first time I'd ever been brought into the office and sat down in front of all of editorial to like pitch an event. And I mean, it's a mini event, but like there were 12 people in the room and I was like, this is what I see happening and this is what I think it is. And like, this is why. And they weren't all sold on it. And I had to sell them on it and say like, you know, Jean Grey, I was like, you guys want Jean Grey back, but we've spent 20 years making her a non-character while the Phoenix is the character. And I was like, I need, if you want Jean back, like the only way to do it is to have her break up with the Phoenix, is to separate them, like have a clean break. And like, it's a force that's been destructive to her as a character, but it's a force that's been destructive to her personally in the universe and not just, you know, aesthetically as a publishing company. And I was like, let's break that. Like, let's break them apart and get Jean back. Like, let's get Stan and Jack's girl back on the page. And I could say that in the room from somewhere. I got that. And they reacted to it and responded to it. And now I feel comfortable saying it in an interview, talking to you, talking right to the public, where I'm like, oh yeah, Clint is like this. And every once in a while, someone's like, well, that's not how I see him. And I'm like, and my answer always sounds snide, but it's not. It's actually the thing I love about Marvel Comics. I say it to people on Twitter and people are like, oh, he's such a jerk. But I earnestly mean it. I say, well, then I look forward to reading your take on it. Because I do. Like, that's what's fun about the Marvel Universe.
Sure, absolutely.
Is like, yeah, there, you know, I have interpretation of something. I mean, one of my favorite things that ever happened at Marvel was I did Phoenix Resurrection. And Marvel said to me, like, okay, now you do the Jean Grey X-Men book. And I was like, I don't want to do that. Like, in my head, Jean isn't in a place to lead a team. I don't know what that would look like. I don't know why she'd do it. It doesn't make sense to me. Like, I put her back, and now she's very vulnerable, and she's very hurt, and she's very confused, and she needs time to heal. Like, and they were like, we're not going to do that book. And I was like, I know. I don't know what the book you want is. Like, I don't want to do it. Can I do New Mutants? And they were like, yeah, you can do New Mutants. And they were kind of annoyed. And they brought in Tom Taylor. And I'm friends with Tom, and Tom's awesome. And Tom knocked it out of the park with X-Men Red. And it wasn't at all what I thought to do. And it's so smart and so great and a book I love so much. And, like, that's, I love that about Marvel. It's amazing. Yeah. I was like, here's a story that I set up. And it went somewhere I completely didn't see coming because Tom's a very different writer than me and has different sensibilities. And that's fun. So when I say to people like, Clint Barton is this person, and they go, that's not who I think Clint is. And I go, well, then I look forward to reading your take. I, I'm being earnest. Like, I want to read different takes on these characters. I want to read people from all walks of life and all perspectives touching them. I think that's the beauty of what we do.
And I mean, that's one of those things where, like, Batman wouldn't do that. Well, Batman's done a lot of things. Like, Batman can be anything you can think of, as long as it's entertaining. And I think that is one of those sort of, like, some fans don't get that, some fans do, some creators get that, and I that's sort of the rich tapestry, just to overblow it. So would you say that there was a certain point, you know, at Marvel where you had a little swagger, where you were able to, you know, you're able to do that? Didn't that, you know, did that change sort of how your work went or how you sort of felt about it? Maybe swagger's not the right word, but it sounds like you need to get it at a certain point.
You need to get at a certain point. You need to act like you belong there. Mm-hmm. I don't think it changed anything. The swagger. The only time I've had swagger and really like thrown my weight around was probably misguided, but was Multiple Man, because when Phoenix Resurrection came out, it did really well, and they called me and were like, "You did good. Like, this was, you know, a hard book, and you did it and you knocked it out of the park, and the fans' reaction was great, and, you know, sales were great, and what do you want?" And I was like, "I want to do a Multiple Man book." And they were baffled, and they were like, "No, we're talking about like X-Force, X-Factor, like something, another X-Men book. Like, what would you like?" And I was like, "No, I want Multiple Man." And I had to go in and have a meeting and talk to them about it, because they were like, "No, you can't." And I said, you know, like, "You guys are giving me a get out of jail free card here. If I'm going to have use a get out of jail free card to get a book, like, you're always going to have an X Factor, you're always going to have an X Force." I was like, "You're never going to do a Multiple Man book unless I'm cashing in chips. Like, I'm cashing in these chips to do something that's weird." Mm-hmm. And I think that for me was really a testing my, how much weight I could throw around, because it was a book that I think, you know, at the end of the day, editorial was very enthusiastic and supportive of the book. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of fans of the company of the book, and I think the book did well, and but they were confused by it a lot. And I think it's not the kind of book that they expect people to go for. Mm-hmm. The ladder is sort of built one way, and when you're on the ladder and kind of looking to the sides, they don't understand in some ways. I mean,
feel like
they do.
You have to be up the ladder if you want to do something off to the side of the ladder at the same time. You can get away with that.
Yeah, if you want to be the Uncanny X-Men writer, you can pick a weird book, but you can't just say my next book is going to be something that's going to hardly sell. Like, that's not good career planning. That's not good publishing strategy. Like, we're investing in you. We're building you up, and you're just picking weird things. Mm-hmm. But I like the weird things. I like I love doing Uncanny X-Men and Punisher and these flagship books, but, like, I like the weird off the beaten path stuff so much, and like, I always want to do that stuff, and I really gravitate towards it. And
I mean, those are the ones that I definitely connected with. Like, you know, I saw you doing a Multiple Man book. Was it Andy McDonald? Am I wrong? Was that right?
Yeah, no, Andy. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, that's all that is fantastic, and it was really whacked out for sure, but it was super fun. Like, are you? I assume that you liked the story and everything you did, but like, that didn't turn out to be a bad business decision, did it?
No. I don't think it was a bad decision in any way, other than like, there are certain career trajectories that make sense. That, like, I think Marvel is protective of us as creators and wants us to be like building bigger names and being smart about what we do. And I think anytime you're like, I want to go four rungs down the ladder and to the left, book-wise, like, I want to go from a book that's selling 100,000 copies to a book that's selling 30. Mm-hmm. Like, they're confused, as they should be, because they want us to be bigger and bigger names. And I want to stake out that chance to do these weird sort of esoteric books. I think that, you know, my Marvel heart, it definitely beats for the big events and the Avengers and the X-Men, but it's just as much, you know, I'm just as much an ecstatics guy. I'm just as much a, you know, the odd little weird kind of, you know, your Visions and your Hawkeyes and your odd books that don't quite fit anywhere. Like, I love those. And so I always want to try and carve that out. And it's maybe not career-wise the best decision, but it is creatively the thing that makes me happiest. So that's what I want to do.
So you're where you wanted to be. You have, you know, over a great many years with a great deal of, missteps and moves forward, and also you're where you want to be. So what happens now? What do you keep your eye on going forward?
Yeah, there's definitely a weird, I had a weird thing 2 years ago at the beginning of 2019, where like, for the first time in my life, I'd done like, here's my 5-year plan. Here's my 10, like, it wasn't even a 5-year plan. It was like a career plan of like, this is what I want to do with my life. I want to at some point write The Punisher and X-Men and Star Wars. And I just looked at my schedule and I was like, oh, I'm writing all three of those. Like, that's it. Like, I don't know what is next. Mm-hmm. And it went from, I was so driven. I spent years like sort of mercilessly towards myself, like climbing the ladder to get to those things. That I really said, when I'm done with X-Men and Punisher, I want to like reward myself by doing the stuff I want to do. And I wanted to do those things, but like doing stuff that is fun, that is like, you know, that I could say I earned and sort of, you know, the multiple man kind of books. So Hawkeye was high on that list for me. Hawkeye is a weird, odd book always. And that's a fun book. And that's a prestige title, as it were. But yeah, I'm doing a bunch of stuff at Marvel coming up that I'm really excited about. You know, I'm doing Forceworks that comes out next month, and people are baffled that I'm doing Forceworks, but I love the original Forceworks. And, you know, Darren, who's the editor, is one of the best editors in comics. And I was just like, Darren, I want to do Forceworks with you. And he was like, yeah, let's do it. And, it's that kind of thing where it's just like, I'm not worried about optics or aesthetics or career planning for a little bit. I'm worried about doing things that feel fulfilling and fun, and Forceworks is just a fun book. And then I'm doing more creator owned stuff. I have a new Image book coming out later this year, called What's the Furthest Place from Here, with Tyler Boss, who did Four Kids Walk into a Bank with me.
Oh yeah.
And I'm really excited about that. I'm working on some other creator owned stuff that we're going to announce later this year. And yeah, it's just for a little bit, I want to just take a year and just wing it and sort of see what I do, mm-hmm. see where it goes.
Keep doing this thing.
Yeah. I
that's fair.
I think, you know, comics is great. It's the best job I've ever had. It's so fun and so rewarding and so fulfilling. It's long hours and real brutal and sort of intense. And I mean, it's a job. It's a hard job, but it's a great job.
You did not arrive unprepared for that, though.
No, not at all. But I spent a long time doing the like the planning and the thinking and the like scheming and the maneuvering and all that stuff. And I'm happy to have reaped the rewards of that I have. You know, people who are kind enough to buy stuff when I put it out, and retailers who are kind enough to order it, and editors who are kind enough to trust me. And I want to just coast on that for a little bit and do some stuff that I think is really fun that I can cut loose on. So
that's awesome. That's what a nice story that we're still in the middle of then. I'm very happy for you.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure I'm going to be back here on 2021 and be like, that was a terrible decision. That was really dumb of me. I really should have tried to be the writer on Venom. I don't know.
There's lots of time. Do all those things.
It'll sure. work out.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for hanging out and chatting with me. This was fun.
Yeah, this was great, Josh. Thank you so much.
And that is all for another episode of Talksplode. Obviously, I want to thank Matt Rosenberg for coming here and hanging out with me and chatting. You can follow him on Twitter at AshcanPress. You can go to iFanboy.com. You can comment on this show. You can look at other Talksplodes we've done, other Booksplodes, and our Pick of the Week podcast. All that stuff is over there. And I want to thank the patrons for the support in general, and for making it possible for me to do these shows regularly again. I know this was supposed to be your December show. It is now the end of January as it comes out. So the point is, here's the show. I hope you enjoy it. Thanks so much for listening. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.